You're listening to Unceded Airwaves by the Indigenous Collective at CITR 101.9 FM. Unceded Airwaves is broadcasting from the traditional, ancestral, unceded lands of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. You're listening to Unceded Airwaves on CITR 101.9 FM. That intro was by David Morin, and that's from his album Every Color, which is a phenomenal song, one of my favorites. I probably play it more often than I should on this show, but I definitely want to give him the airtime he deserves. So as I said, this is Unceded Airwaves. We are the Indigenous Collective at CITR. We are broadcasting from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. My name is Lisa Gerbov, and I am Simshan from the Simshan Territory, which is located near the mouth of the Skeena River. It's just east of Haida Gwaii, and it's near the southern tip of Alaska. I'm an uninvited guest on the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh territories while I study at UBC, and this is something that we are mindful of in the production of this show and the conduct of the Indigenous Collective. And I want to thank you for tuning in to Season 2, Episode 5 of Unceded Airwaves. Our continued thoughts are going out to the Heltsik Nation, who has started salvage work for the Nathan E. Stewart wreck site. And to add to the devastation, on Sunday, a barge called the Columbia Lane carrying sand and gravel flipped in the inside passage near Bella Bella as well. That's a U.S. registered tug that was towing the barge from Seattle to Juneau, Alaska, when the cargo shifted, causing the barge to roll over and take on water. All four people on board the tug are currently safe, and according to the Joint Rescue Coordination Center spokesperson John Nethercott, there is, quote-unquote, no environmental damage, you know, except for all the cargo that now sits on the bottom of the inside passage. But I am joined in the studio today by the Indigenous Collective. First, I want to say hello to Nikita. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. How are you?
Great.
So my name is Nikita Day. I'm a third-year student here at UBC, and I am Tahltan from the Tahltan Territory. But I grew up in Smithers, which is on Wet'suwet'en Territory. I know we've all been going through a bit of a rough time over the past 24 hours. I am, of course, talking about the 2016 U.S. presidential election. And later on in the show, we will be reading out some tweets about the unexpected results.
Yeah, a little bit later on in the second half of the show. And we're also joined by Mario Parent and Matt Andrietta came into the studio last minute. I'm so stoked that you're here.
Yeah, hello, hello. My name is Mario Parent. I'm a third-year FNIS major at UBC. I'm a Niska from my mother and born and raised in the Smalek-speaking territories of the Gitxsan and Tsimshian. And last week was the Niska election. Congratulations to Eva Clayton, the first of many female presidents to come. In balloting took place November 2nd with results released November 4th. Clayton received 836 votes to 640 for previous president Mitchell Stevens. The LISM's government elections are held every 4 years. I'm also joined here by Matt.
Yeah, I'm Matt Andrietta. I'm a member of the Qualicum First Nation with relations to Musqueam, as well as Italian ancestry on my father's side from Langley, BC, where I was raised off reserve. On Stolo land, actually.
I didn't know that you were raised in Langley.
Yep.
Yeah, so you're like, you've kind of been like all over the lower mainland. You have ties almost everywhere.
A little bit. Yeah, basically.
Here and there.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm meeting all sorts of cousins all over the place all the time. It's awesome.
I feel like that's kind of like what you do, when you kind of move around, you meet people who, like for myself, I'm Simshan, and I find that living in Vancouver, I run into other Simshan people that I never met before, and you just kind of like run into them at different events, and it's just kind of one of those things that happens within the culture. You kind of meet people all over the place.
And I'm working a lot at Musqueam too this year specifically, and it's been pretty awesome and funny, the amount of relatives I've been introduced to that I did not know.
That's awesome. Before.
And it's been amazing growing community and a sense of self through that.
Awesome. Well, we want to get on with the show today. We have a great segment coming up a little bit later on. But first of all, this show is put on every week by UBC's Indigenous Radio Collective, who you are hearing right now on the show. We are a collective of Indigenous and non-Indigenous students who use this weekly airtime to discuss issues and events that are important to us. And, of course, entertainment, too. So we're using this weekly airtime as an opportunity for our own self-representation, which is not often afforded to Indigenous people in media. So this gives us the opportunity to define who we are as Indigenous peoples, instead of relying on inaccurate representations of our cultures, lived experiences, and identities in broadcast media. And we find that it is often difficult to find relatable Indigenous role models and people in media more generally. So we hope to highlight some Indigenous peoples doing great stuff out in the world.
Yeah, so our goal in this show is to center the voices of Indigenous people and to create narratives that empower our stories. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Unceded Airwaves. And if you'd like to get involved, you can send us a message on social media. We have an Indigenous collective meeting tomorrow from 4 to 5 p.m. at CITR in the Nest, and there will be snacks.
I love snacks.
Love snacks, too. If this show is something you identify with, then we'd encourage you to come out. Everyone is welcome, and there's no experience necessary. If you want to get involved, but you're hesitant about being on air, there are plenty of other ways that you can participate in this collective.
Right. Like Nikita said, you can follow Unceded Airwaves on Facebook and Twitter. If you have an Indigenous artist that we should know about, send us a tweet using the hashtag Unceded Music, or send us a Facebook message at Unceded Airwaves, and we'll do our best to get it on in the air. And if we play your song, we'll give a shout out to you as well. We'd love to hear from you, our listeners, what Indigenous artists you're into right now and what events you're attending or promoting. And as always, we'll post a link to the podcast of this episode after the show.
We'll have the weekly Unceded events listing to share with you later in the show, and we'll be reading tweets from the U.S. presidential election, as we mentioned before, in the second half of the show. Also this week, we have two Unceded Airwaves special segments. Josh Gabbert Doyen produced a segment for this week on the No Dakota Access Pipeline. And also with Remembrance Day coming up on Friday, November 11th, we are going to start the show with a podcast segment on National Aboriginal Veterans Day by Indigenous Collective member Lisa Gerbov.
National Aboriginal Veterans Day is commemorated on November 8th. According to Veterans Affairs Canada, more than 7,000 Aboriginal peoples served in World War I, World War II, and the Korean War, plus an unknown number of Inuit, Métis, and non-status Indians. Some estimates go as high as 12,000 Aboriginal people participated in these wars. The Day of Remembrance for Aboriginal Veterans began in 1994 in Winnipeg and has been growing ever since. Every year in November, I witness the Remembrance Day ceremonies as my way of understanding the atrocities of war, what motivates a society to go to war, and to try to figure out how to avoid repeating those histories. My name is Lisa Gerbov, and this is a special segment for Unceded Airwaves on CITR 101.9 FM. I am Simshan from the Simshan Nation and grew up in my territory in the city of Prince Rupert. I recognize that I am an uninvited guest on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. My education has come from the provincial public school system, which has taught me to be mindful of the sacrifices that Canadian citizens have made to defend the nation-state, with a particular emphasis on World War I and World War II. Despite watching these ceremonies and observing national news coverage, I had yet to hear an Indigenous perspective about how First Nations, Inuit, and Métis people were involved in and affected by war. I recognize that the term Aboriginal was created by the Canadian state, and that it has been used as a blanket term to describe First Nations, Métis, and Inuit people, and that when it's possible, it's preferable to use specific names of nations. But for the purpose of this podcast, and where it's appropriate, I will use the term Aboriginal to be inclusive of all Indigenous peoples who have enlisted in war for this country. This year, I decided to skip class to try to learn about what it meant for Aboriginal people to serve in war. I started my inquiry by talking to Legion members who I met on the UBC campus and who were selling Remembrance Day poppies. They put me in touch with the Friendship Center, where I was put in touch with one of the organizers of National Aboriginal Veterans Day. Unceded Airwaves and CITR 101.9 FM was invited to cover the ceremony. The event started at 9 a.m. at Carnegie Hall at Main and Hastings in Vancouver. This was a ceremony like no other that I had witnessed for war veterans. There was plenty of drumming and singing, juxtaposed with moments of silence. There were prayer songs followed by commemoration speeches. We heard from veterans, representatives from the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, Lummi, and Tsawwassen First Nations, as well as state officials. At Carnegie Hall, I witnessed my first ever pipe ceremony, something sacred and not appropriate to broadcast the details of. The veterans, elders, and knowledge keepers directed the events and the ceremony. The Chinese Veteran Group and the Métis Nation of BC were invited and recognized in the ceremony. This was also a historic event for the fact that this was the first time any Lieutenant Governor had attended National Aboriginal Veterans Day in Vancouver. The Lieutenant Governor of BC, Judith Guichon, was blanketed in a ceremony at Carnegie Hall. After the ceremony at Carnegie Hall, the veterans were joined in a march down Hastings to the cenotaph at Victory Square at Cambion Hastings. This event was intimate and inclusive, allowing for community members to participate by bringing their own drums for the march to Victory Square, beating their hand drums to the beat of a heart. Youth from the Native Education College carried the wreaths to the cenotaph. Union of BC Indian Chiefs President Stuart Phillip made a speech at Victory Square, and there were speeches made by local and provincial government representatives. Following the ceremony at Victory Square, there was a reception at the Aboriginal Friendship Center. The youth, myself included, were asked to help serve lunch to the elders and veterans. The veterans were honored with songs and a blanket ceremony by mid-afternoon. The speeches and drumming continued, and we were given the opportunity to shake hands with all the veterans in attendance. This is when I caught up with Robert Nahaney, the master of ceremonies for the event.
Yeah, I'm Robert Nahaney from the Squamish Nation here in North Vancouver. I served with the military from 1960 to 1974. I served in the militia in North Vancouver in the early part, and then I served with the regular forces for 11 years, I think it was, between 1963 and 1974. And I served four times overseas, once with the NATO forces in Europe for 3 years, and then I did two tours in the Middle East with the United Nations. And then I did a tour with a unit called Ace Mobile up in the northern part of Europe on the Russian border in Norway. I don't know if I should be telling you this, but that's what I served. And I was stationed in 1963. I got stationed in regular forces in Edmonton, and I had just turned 17. And when I signed up there, I went through basic training. And then I did what I call my leading infantry training there. And then I did my airborne training with the 2nd Battalion PPCLI. And when I graduated out of that, they transferred me over to Europe for 3 years with NATO forces. And then I came back in 1966, 67, and I was stationed in Edmonton. And then from there in 1968, they sent me over to Cyprus. And the funny thing about it, I laugh about it today, because I walked into camp one morning and they said the sergeant major wanted to see me down at the company office. So I go down there and he says, we want you to go downstairs, have your medical, get your pay, get your leave. You're going to Cyprus. And I said, I didn't volunteer to go. He says, did you volunteer for the Army? And I said, yeah. He said, you're going to Cyprus. So that's how I got to go over with the United Nations peacekeeping forces in Cyprus. And we spent 6 months over there. And over there, we weren't really engaged in any kind of warfare other than separating the two factions that were the Greek Cypriots and the Turkish Cypriots and the Nationals and both matters. And they called it the Corporal's War because the corporal dealt with everything that was happening in during the day. If there was any kind of incidents, it was the corporal that had to deal with it. And so So we got experience in doing our resolution, solution, and problem solving over there with every incident came up, and it was all kinds of cases that did come up with it. I don't want to get into it because there's several. But, you know, really enjoyed doing that kind of work. I mean, it kept us away from our families for that time, but we were out there to save lives, prevent these people from shooting at each other and killing each other. And we were in between. We were like the referees. And I was over there twice. Once again in 1970-71, I was over there in Cyprus for the second time. But I was involved with communications at the time. Then I came back and I was stationed in Calgary. And from there, at that time, we were training. I was part of a training company in Calgary, training new recruits that came into the service, and I'm training people that were going into what they called at that time the Airborne Regiment. And a lot of them were just young kids like myself when I joined up. I mean, here I was just turning 17 when I came in. A lot of people ask me, well, why did you serve? Well, I didn't want to go to jail. The lifestyle that I was living at that time was pretty rough. And I seen one of my relatives go to jail for 3 years. And I started counting, 17, 18, 19, 20. And I didn't want to spend that time. So I told my father, I got to get out of here. And he asked me, well, how? I said, well, I'm going to join the military. And so he signed the papers, and away I went, and I was gone for that time. And then I came back, and here I am here sitting as a veteran. And I never really thought anything about being a veteran. When I came back, I just wanted to get back into being a civilian and get back to working. But my uncle, he started this project a number of years ago about acknowledging the Aboriginal veterans. Him and an entourage of people went over to Europe and visited all the cemeteries over there where our relatives were born, buried. And when he came back, he was getting up in age, and he brought me down to where his brother was buried, because his dad interred his son's body and brought him home. So he brought me down there, and he said, this is your uncle. He's the one that got killed in Holland. He says, we need somebody to remember what our people have done for this great country of Canada, the Dominion. And so when you look back in our history, and he started teaching me, then I started to realize how involved our people were. If you look around this great city of Vancouver, our people were involved in the development of the waterfront, of the communities. My great-grandmother, we have a song that we sing, and it's called the Paddle Song. And when the city of Vancouver was burning in the early, late 1800s, people got in their canoes and paddled over to Vancouver. And this is the song that they sang, and the song was asking, as we know, the Creator to help them, because we were just poor, pitiful human beings and we needed help. And that's what they were praying for when they were coming across the Burrard Linnet, to help the people. So that's where my lineage comes from, and how the people loved. And when there was a call of duty or there was a call of help, we were willing to go. And that's what my uncle said. We heard that there were people in Europe asking for help, so he volunteered. That was in his, what we call our teachings, or his way of life. So he volunteered to go and help them as best he can. And there was, like I said, some 50 other people that went overseas to help the people.
We started our conversation in the main hall at the Aboriginal Friendship Center, but I was worried that the cedar paddles that were used for percussion in the background would disrupt the audio, so we moved outside.
Well, actually, there's a lot of teachings to that paddle.
Really?
And it has to do with the females, because in our language we call it Akhpe, and that's a cedar. And a cedar is called the tree of life to our people, because in the old days the tree gave us everything. Gave us medicine, gave us tools, it gave us transportation, it gave us homes, and it gave us this way of life. And it's the women that carry those paddles, and they use that when they sing. So the reason why the women carry it is because they're recognized as the life givers and the carriers of the teachings. That's what I understand. In the early part of the Second World War in North Vancouver, The way it was told to me by my uncle was that the population of the Otslahan, as I know it today, the traditional name, the village that I live in, and it's at the foot of Lonsdale, and it's recognizable because it's got a church there with two large silver steeples. And that village, the population at that time was 250. And from what I understand, or the way that my uncle was telling me, is that 50 of our people served in the American and the Canadian armed forces during the Second World War. We recognized three elders that went off to the First World War. And I had the great fortune of meeting one of them. His name was Andy Natrell Uppel. And he was a great man, very spiritual, very faithful to his beliefs. And he always encouraged us to go to the natural laws of our people, the tradition, culture, and spirituality. And I think that was the answering of the call of our people, was that when people are in trouble, they need help. So they put everything down and they go and help with as best they can. And that's what my uncle was telling me, that that's what they were doing. They were going to help people that were in trouble.
Aboriginal veterans who returned home after World War I, World War II, and the Korean War became enfranchised. Enfranchisement is a legal process where a person's Indian status is eliminated and replaced with Canadian citizenship. This was a process of assimilation into Canadian society, effectively surrendering Aboriginal legal and ancestral identities for membership into the dominant society. Enfranchisement was originally a voluntary process introduced in the Gradual Civilization Act of 1857, but became mandatory with the Indian Act of 1876. When veterans came back from war, they were enfranchised, meaning that they lost their status rights and became Canadian citizens. Yet Aboriginal veterans were not afforded the same rights that non-Native veterans received. Aboriginal veterans were lost in the state bureaucracy, where both the Department of Veterans Affairs and the then Department of Indian Affairs absolved themselves from the responsibility to assist Aboriginal war vets returning to Canadian society. Enfranchised Aboriginal veterans were denied the same services, support, education, and land benefits offered to non-Aboriginal veterans, while at the same time they lost the benefits that their friends and relatives received as status Indians living on reserves. I asked Robert what he knew about enfranchisement.
At that time, in the early part of the war, my understanding is, and actually I met a brother that was enfranchised out because he joined the forces, and at that time we weren't Canadian citizens. We were Indians. And at that time, in order for us to join forces, we had to give up our Indian rights, and so there was quite a few that did that. Enfranchised out to join the military. And when you're enfranchised out, you gave up a lot of opportunity, but yet at the same time, when the veterans came back from those wars, they didn't have the same benefits as the non-Native veterans. So those are some of the things that they look at. Like my uncle Jimmy, he told me that he had to pay for his own education. He had to do it through mail. And to get grade 12, he had to pay for it out of his own pocket. And that's some of the things that they looked at. There was land grants that were given. There was grants given for education, not only for themselves, but for their families. But our Native veterans didn't get it. They didn't get it. I look here at downtown Vancouver, and as a Native person and growing up here, there are places we were permitted to go into. And there was racism and discrimination when I was growing up. I remember that. Like even when we started into public schools in the early 60s, there was a lot of racism and discrimination happening because Natives weren't permitted to go beyond grade 8. There was a law. If you became of age of 16 or grade 8, you're let out of class. You had to go to work. And consequently, I think I recall in a lot of these, what they call residential schools, on top of that, there was places called industrial schools. The school I went to was an industrial school. They made their own shoes, their own uniforms. It was like a farm. It was like a ranch. They had cattle, they had chickens, they had turkeys, they had fields and fields of vegetables growing in there, and it was the kids that were taking care of it. Kids, children, because I was only 7 years old when I went there. So yeah, we know the impacts of some of that discrimination and racism as we were growing up.
Despite these factors, I asked Robert what motivated people to join the armed forces.
Well, that sense of comradeship and unity of the land, of this land to protect it. I think that was the energy that they had at the time, because the majority of the veterans that I talked to throughout my history, the ones that I met during the Second World War, they said that they were there to protect the people and to protect the land and to protect the way of life that we were engaged in recovering, actually. Because at that time, pre-Second World War, there were a lot of laws against our people that did not permit us to participate. Like you know, that enfranchisement. You had to give up your Indian rights. And at the same time, you know, we look at the early 1923, I think it was, when the Potlatch Law came out, and we were forbidden to participate in any of our cultural, spiritual, traditional ways of life. And today, they've opened that door. The veterans have opened up that door since then. So that law was changed, I think, in 1950. And then the government of Canada said, now you're allowed to participate in ceremony. So those are some of the things that we look at. And on top of the veterans that served in the military, we have what we call the forgotten warriors, the ones that carried on even through that law of the potlatch not permitting us to participate. When we say if there's been repercussions of our people going there, you know, we take a look at our system here in our communities. And, you know, when we just did a lot of reconciliation with residential school. And a lot of that reconciliation is repairing some of the impacts of that loss of language, loss of culture, loss of tradition. I got grandchildren that I'm teaching now, the tradition and the culture and the spirituality I know. That's what was brought back from our veterans. They encouraged that. Today we're working at that. It's the young people. I think the greatest gift that we got from it was that our young people are picking up on that tradition, culture, and spirituality today. That's what I recognize. So yeah, our people gave up a lot, but they still persevere today. They want to continue on being Stalmuk, people of this land. They still say that they're Canadians.
As Robert said to me off mic, when you lose your identity, that's a pretty harsh thing to get back. I asked him what it meant to have the Lieutenant Governor of BC, Judith Guichon, attend the National Aboriginal Veterans Day ceremony in Vancouver.
Well, I think it's talking about the partnerships that we're gaining by the work that we do, the comradeship, the collective thought of looking at resolution solutions to things other than sitting down and being armed about it, but be able to sit down and sit at the table and come to some kind of agreement and a solution. I think that's the best way to do that. And that shows that it's visual. So when it becomes visual, people think she represents the Queen. And the Queen, the royalty, and Canada came together in 1763 so that Canada could become a dominion. And so there was a proclamation that was signed by Canada and by the royalty. In 1906, our elders went across to England because there was agreements made for Canada to be Canada, that our inherent right would be looked after and never lost. And our people went over there in 1906 and said, we're still alive and we're still on the land. That's the message I carry as a veteran. We're still alive and we're still on the land, because our natural laws are what govern us. And if we don't have those natural laws, we're not stumbling, we're not people of this land.
I asked Robert what this meant to have city representatives, including Mayor Gregor Robertson, in attendance at the ceremony.
There's a proclamation of this from the city So that's why we do it every year. And we do it collectively. And like I say, when I say not samat in our language, that means one mind, one heart, we'll do it together. And that's been told to us in our legends, in some of the prophecies that we have been told to us, that we would come together and work hard together for world peace. Just as that Chunupa, the pipe, said, world peace, it's sacred life. That's what we're looking at. Just the sacredness of this life is important, and that's how our old ones looked at it. Our babies are sacred. That's why I look at my granddaughter today and say, I love you.
I asked Robert if there was anything else we needed to know about National Aboriginal Veterans Day.
Well, I think the biggest thing is that I always remember what my uncle always said. He said, you know, we learn from our mistakes. And if there are mistakes made, we learn from them. And we can make changes. And that's what we're working at. Like, you take a look at now, you know, we're still under the Indian Act. Is that a human right for someone to tell us what to do and what we can't do? So that's something that we're addressing in a most peaceful, loving way. We want to do that.
I'd like to thank Robert Nahaney for making the time to speak with me about National Aboriginal Veterans Day. And I would also like to thank the organizers for putting on this event every year. At the Cenotaph in Victory Square, Dr. Hetty Fry, the Member of Parliament for Vancouver Centre, said something that stuck with me. She acknowledged that while First Nations, Métis, and Inuit people fought in World War I and World War II and the Korean War, we were still not given the right to vote in Canada until 1960, unless they were enfranchised. My name is Lisa Gerbov, and this is a special segment for Unceded Airwaves on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
most powerful motivational speeches that I have ever heard came from people who told me I couldn't do something. You know why? Because when they told me I couldn't do it, I was bound and determined to show them that I could.
All Access Pass is back for season 2. We are a collectively run weekly program that discusses equity, inclusion, and accessibility issues on and off UBC's campus, including both visible and invisible disabilities. Anyone can get involved. No experience is necessary. People of all abilities are welcome to join. Check us out on Facebook at All Access Pass or get involved by emailing accessibilitycollective@citr.ca.
This is Nicole from UBC Heart and Stroke Foundation Club. Here at HSF, we aim to promote health and wellness, provide financial and volunteer support for the Heart and Stroke Foundation of BC and Yukon, and foster interest in cardiovascular disease research. If you want to be part of an amazing community of heartthrobs, learn more at www.ubchsf.com.
All right, you heard a clip just before the break. That was Skookum Sound System with Star Wars Canoe Mix, which is surprisingly one of the songs that I'm currently obsessed with. But before that, you also heard a segment on National Aboriginal Veterans Day that I recorded yesterday at the Vancouver Friendship Center with Robert Nahaney. Next up, though, we have our unseated events listings that is going to be read by our Indigenous collective. So start us off, Matt.
Yeah, so the Squamish Annual Veterans Powwow is going to be held at Chief Joe Mathias Center in North Vancouver. There will be a cenotaph ceremony starting at 10 to 10:30 a.m. near the Catholic Church in North Vancouver, and at 11 a.m. where there will be a moment of silence to honor past and present veterans. The powwow starts at about 12:30 or 1 p.m., of course depending on the veteran ceremony that's happening earlier in the morning. There will be two grand entries, 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. Our host drum, Oceanside Dakota, with Darcy Demas, MC Ian Owenan B, AD John Miller, head male dancer, Russell Cardinal, female head dancer, Gloria Nahani. They still need volunteers that day of the event and food donations for the community feast. Contact Tony Discon via Facebook for more info.
All right, and next up?
Yeah, we have the Standing Rock Solidarity Round Dance and at the Stop Kinder Morgan Rally. That's part of the wider Stop Kinder Morgan No Consent, No Pipeline rally in March. They're calling for a big drum and hand drummers in regalia to lead the march on Saturday, November 19th on unceded Coast Salish territories. It's taking place outside of the Vancouver City Hall, 12 till 3 p.m. They'll form a drum and prayer circle for a round dance in the center of the rally when they arrive at Liberty Library Square, all in solidarity with the Standing Rock Sioux and water protectors fighting to stop the Dakota Access Pipeline. For more information on that or to confirm details of your participation, you can contact Juanita Desjarlais. That's Juanita Lynn, L-Y-N, at me.com, or at 604-616-7922, or Jody Leon, Jody underscore Royce, R-O-Y-C-E, at hotmail.com, or 250-306-1240. That's also all on Facebook.
Perfect. And we have one more event listing that Nikita is going to share with us.
Yes, so the TAI is partnering with Journalists for Human Rights to offer a 3-month paid in fellowship for an emerging Indigenous reporter. So the successful candidate will join the Vancouver newsroom and work with TAI editors to develop an in-depth reporting project on a public interest issue, while also having the opportunity to work on breaking stories. They're looking for someone with big ideas and a commitment to creative journalism. The position is made possible through JHR's Indigenous Reporters Program, now in its second year. The program aims to increase the quality and quantity of Indigenous stories and voices in Canada and Canadian media, as well as offer Indigenous youth a pathway towards pursuing a journalism career. Past fellowships have joined newsrooms such as Aboriginal People's Television Network, Global TV, and CBC Aboriginal.
And for more info, we're going to post that on our Facebook and Twitter pages for you under the hashtag Unseated Events for our events listing. Next up, we have another special segment from Josh Gabert-Doyen, who was in here earlier. You just heard him talking about the Standing Rock Solidarity event. And this was contributed for this week's show, and we are very appreciative. It's on the No Dakota Access Pipeline, so check it out.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the University of British Columbia, situated on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded land of the Musqueam people. You're tuned into Unceded Airwaves, produced by CITR's Indigenous Collective. My name is Josh Gabardois. I'm a white settler originally from the unceded Kanehekaha Territory. There have been over 400 arrests at the No Dakota Access Pipeline protests since they started in April. The proposed Dakota Access Pipeline, currently being built by the Texas-based Energy Transfer Partners, passes not far from the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe Reservation, going through major waterways and threatening the clean water supply of local indigenous communities. The pipeline is set to traverse burial grounds and sacred sites. Numerous protest camps have been set up on the bank of the Cannonball River, accompanied by legal action to halt the pipeline. Hundreds of nations have joined the Sioux at Standing Rock, coming from across the United States and over the border from Canada. Protesters have been met by local police force, state police, out-of-state police agencies, the National Guard, and private security forces. They've been shot by rubber bullets, tear gas, and attacked by dogs. There have been over 400 arrests of protesters so far. Lena Minifee is a reporter and editor of Ricochet's Indigenous Reporting Fund and comes from the Tsimshian Nation. Lena is calling us from Minnesota, having just returned from Standing Rock. Thank you for making the time to speak with us at Unceded Airwaves. Can you give a little introduction for yourself for listeners?
Hi, Josh. Thanks for having me. I'm Lena Minifee. I'm Gisipwada from the House of Widali, and I'm from Gehahla, which is people qualify as Tsimshian under our language group. Thank you for having me today.
Thank you. For our listeners, can you just give us a quick overview of what water protectors and protesters have been fighting against at Standing Rock?
Well, water protectors who have been set up at camp since April of this year, 2016, have been trying to protect their water, which consists of the Missouri River, as well as Lake Oahe, from being crossed with a gigantic oil pipe from the Balkan areas that's supposed to be delivering oil to a few states down to be refined. And this is a pipeline, you have to understand, that was rejected by Bismarck, so by a non-Native town, and they decided to move it across Native territories because, honestly, our Native people always have their backyards filled with toxins or filled with risk because they don't want it near potentially white people.
Can you describe the camp at Standing Rock for me? What sort of camp has emerged down there?
Yeah, there's a lot of different sections of the camp. You have to understand that it really started with Sacred Stone Camp. This is a territory that has had traditional camps for time immemorial. The last recorded known time for camping was still in the late 60s for this territory, and they signed a treaty so they could still have use of this land in 1851. So Sacred Stone Camp was there, and it was a very spiritual camp, and now there's been multiple camps that have been around. I'd say, like, once you come into camp, you start to realize maybe it's like 15 football fields, 20, quite giant, and there's a couple different ridges and hills where there's a Rosebud camp that's up there, as well as a Pine Ridge for the Dakota people who are wanting to stay within their own people, so they have places to go when they come to Standing Rock as well. So the one that everyone's camping at now is Oshetee Shikoi, and at the Standing Rock Camp. It's surrounded by the Missouri River, but it's a little bit further, it's a little far away, like a few miles away from where the oil pipeline is crossing the river.
The direct action there began in April, and it's now November. There seems to be no clear end in sight. Are there preparations being made for winter?
Yeah, when I was out there last time, it was about winterization. Right now, it's about protecting that pipe going across the Missouri River. So they set up last week. They had winterized. Part of the winterization move was that they're going to set up a camp right on the Missouri River, right in the way of the pipeline, much like Winnestone has done. And so they went with about 200 people and set up wet lodges and teepees and tents. That was last week on that Thursday, a week ago, where after they got, it was called the Treaty Camp set up, that's when the police descended and arrested 141 people after inflicting some harm. You know, there was reports of a broken arm, rubber bullet, tear gas, macing, and maltreatment of people, shoving them into these kind of dog kennels in a basement, putting numbers on their arms. Even one instance, I talked to an elder who was put into solitary confinement during this time.
How would you perceive the larger social context down in this region? Are there settler-state indigenous tensions outside of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe camp?
Well, every time I go up, I mean, I've gone up twice now, and I plan to go up a third time. Every time I grab papers from the local area, whether that be Bismarck or Cannonball, I grab some papers. And from the beginning, there's just this rhetoric of those people are violent. They're watch out, protect your kids. They have weapons out there, which all of to this day has been disproven. Even so far, Amy Goodman, I think yesterday, went on video with Dallas, who's one of the main organizers from Indigenous Environmental Network, and they had proved that the guy who had the gun, the AR-15, was a DAPL worker who was pointing it at people and trying to infiltrate the camp and trying to set off violence. So it's really strange to be in the States and see a different, really slanted, racist coverage, whether that be Fox News or CNN the other day, finding the, you know, the five Lakota people who don't like the camp out of the, like, tens of thousands who are supportive of it, and giving that the same voice, or giving the ideas that these people are violent and terrible and, you know, angry Indians, scaring people in North Dakota, and keeping in that kind of narrative is, yeah, it's been very strange to watch that play out.
How big a part is resource extraction for that economy, kind of the local regional economy?
It's like the main North Dakota, like I think there's hundreds of pipelines that are already through North Dakota at this point. And you can say the same for Saskatchewan and our territories. And, you know, a lot of those places that used to be lush, the more research I do, they used to have marshes and buffalo and 200 different types of bird species. And with 107 dams, it just decimated like the water, and so desert and dry, and then people's territories were like less than westernized. The western people who are extractive and extractive industries and business are the ones who actually made it to be that way. So that's all they have to be able to take things out of the ground and sell them. I guess North Dakota wants it to stop now, you know, majority indigenous people do, and not just indigenous but non-indigenous.
How has social media played a part in the coverage of the protests?
Social media is a huge part of the protest. You have to understand, though, that they're using military-grade technological warfare against people who are at Standing Rock, though. So they have like, stingrays they're not supposed to be using. There's apparently an inquiry that they're actually doing that without the permission of the federal government. They have cell phone receptor blockers. They have their own drones they're looking at. And then when they found out that Standing Rock had drones, then they put... Then they put in an air restriction enforcement on that and try to shoot down the Native people's drones. But these drone videos are being put on social media. People are doing live Facebook streams, which wouldn't have let the world know what was happening when it was happening. You can't edit that stuff, so it's a lot more transparent and I think a lot more engaging because you can see it as it's happening when people are being treated poorly by the cops. And these cops are coming from all over. They ask for help from every single state, and they send your sheriff, send your state officers, and they all said yes. And so now seven different states have sent all of their cops up there, and one being from Minneapolis, who's the sheriff here, and he's the one who brought all the technological and kind of more military work and technology up there. So nobody would know all this stuff without social media, because the mainstream media just kind of was silent, and they're kind of just picking up on it now, I think, really quickly shifting because of the pressure of social media. Mainstream news can't ignore it anymore because they can see the evidence for themselves.
What was the overall feeling like at the camp on the most recent visit you've made?
It was mixed. I'd say I went up right after the 141 arrests were there, so people were quite upset, especially seeing their loved ones and seeing people they've been in camp with be treated or mistreated by police and see them get hurt. And they were missing, but I was there the day that they actually all were released as well. So that was the rejoice and celebration of everybody being out. That day there was also a fire, it looked like on the other side of the road, that was set. We don't know who set it yet. That report still has to come out, but it was a huge grass fire. Some people think at this point they're speculating that it was meant to smoke us out. Like, why would people set a fire to their own place where they have babies, like newborn babies are there, and elders and animals. There was helicopters flying in and delivering water to put out that fire all morning, even not start at 1 o'clock in the morning. Decided to put it out like about 10 in the morning. So it's mixed and, you know, it's tense, but then there's these really amazing sacred spaces. Like there's still Sweatlots is going, there's still, you know, Native American Church, Ceylon is going, there's still the Sacred Fire in the middle where people come together and they still, at nighttime, people do traditional songs or dance, or they just go into powwow or 49 songs. So there's still like this really amazing spirit of togetherness, and you talk to your neighbor's camp and you get to know people and you just find out who each other is, you know, how you know each other from across the land. Like, oh, I know so-and-so from your area, and do you know this person? And so there's this familial, really familial and wonderful feel that I always get when I'm with my people, and up there because there's thousands of people there, you know, so that's still a beautiful, beautiful place.
In the Ricochet podcast that you did a few weeks back, you talked about how ceremonies have actually been stopping some of the assembling of the pipeline. Can you describe how that's unfolded? How have these ceremonies been used to stop work?
There's a lot of different tactics being used to stop the work. People put themselves on the line yesterday by putting themselves in the cold water, and it's really cold now. It's almost becoming, it's going from fall to winter up there. So they were going into the water and with their arms up and saying, like, please stop, don't put the pipeline in. And so people are in prayer when they do that, and some of the frontline people are a little bit more aware. They're not saying, you know, they're not really necessarily saying they're in prayer. But there's an elder that took us out on Thursday. He took a big group of the camp out to walk up to the bridge, and they did a jingle dress dance, which actually comes from a pretty, it's not just for powwow, it's a pretty sacred, in the original story where it comes from. Like, they're the people who were arrested the other day at the treaty camp, which they try to set up for winterizing. They were in sweat lodges and stuff too, and they're ripping the sweat lodges down and taking their sacred ceremony. And their pipes that was taken, of like a really sacred staff was taken, feathers were taken. So, I mean, people are in ceremony all the time because they're gathered together with medicine people there. And that's kind of the holdover from Sacred Stone Camp. So, yeah, when you go to the line, there's somebody who's doing prayers. That prayer is supposed to keep people in a good heart in a good way in order to peacefully protest for those who want to peacefully protest, and to kind of set the mindset and the spirit for what they want, which is protecting the water and kind of keeping themselves and praying in connection to that water. The Lakota, Dakota people are really known for being very generous with their ceremonies. A lot of our people, even up to Canada, in different areas, have been taught or practiced some of these ceremonies. And so they're calling on their spiritual families and elders, and they're calling them to come back and help them now. There's that connection that that kind of goes bigger than social media could ever go. That tie is really important.
One of the things I've noticed with how a lot of outlets have been covering the No Dapo protest has been kind of, in a sense, there hasn't been much talk about the region's history as a site of Indigenous resistance. Could you talk to me a little bit about that history and the history of Standing Rock?
Well, there's a lot of history of Standing Rock. So that was a place of Sitting Bull. It was one of the most known warriors in all of North America. So, I mean, you'd have to look up, I can't go to the entire story of Sitting Bull, but you can, we have the internet, so you can look it up. But he was from there. But there's all these different, it was one people at once, right? So the Lakotas were all together. And then they've been split up, whether that be through war, direct war, like Wounded Knee or massacres, or land relocations that were intentional to break up the powerful people. Sitting Bull was part of that. He was part of that resistance. He ended up actually flying up Canada in order to leave for a while, but Standing Rock is a place where he's from, and a lot of people are from, and everyone's related to each other. They know, and even though they're far away, they know each other's families and where they're from, and it extends all the way up to Alberta and Saskatchewan to those people. So.
Just as a final note, I wanted to ask you what your sense was of how the protests are going to go moving forward. How do you think things are going to continue?
Well, if you watch any of the video from yesterday where people have their hands up and they're just standing in the water and the police blatantly start shooting rubber bullets at them in the face at point blank range, and they are tear gassing them and making them every chance they get, I think the police are out to harm people at this point who aren't doing anything. There was no fire lit yesterday. There's people who are like half clothed in a very cold river standing there saying, please don't build, you know, and they're they're kind of shooting, they're shooting rubber bullets and spraying mace, and they're not asking questions at all. They're just kind of going ahead as per, I'm sure, their sheriff wants them to do. So there was a point when I thought maybe that there were some police on the line where maybe they're responding to being talked to and being like, you know, people say, like, we're protecting, they'll yell at them, like, we're protecting your kids' water, too. We're protecting your drinking water, too, you and your kids and your grandkids, and trying to, you know, reach them. And it doesn't seem like at this point they're reachable, and that it's not going to get easier for the people who are on the front line right now.
Thanks for taking the time to talk to Unceded Airwaves today. I really appreciate it.
Welcome. Thank you, Josh.
That was Lena Minifee calling from Minnesota last week after her most recent trip to Standing Rock. The music for this segment is Rollerblade by the Navajo punk band Disco Taze from their Protect the Walk Tour demo. Song picked by Lena. This segment was produced by me, Josh Gabaguano, for Unceded Airwaves. Special thanks to Lisa Gerbau for production help, and Lena for agreeing to take part in this interview. This is Unceded Airwaves on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded land of the Musqueam people. Thanks for listening.
Now in its 16th year, Media Democracy Days brings together media makers, activists, and educators to celebrate independent media and social change. Media Democracy Days is happening this year at the Central Branch of the Vancouver Public Library on November 15th and 16th. The event includes a community radio takeover of the Inspiration Lab on the 15th and 16th at the Central Branch of the Vancouver Public Library, and a full day of hands-on workshops, discussions, and collaboratively determined events on November 19th at SFU Vancouver's Harbor Center campus. This year's keynote speaker is Ryan McMahon of the Red Man Laughing podcast. The event is free to attend. Visit 2016.mediademocracydays.ca for a full program.
At Dunkin' Donuts, each and every
radio show
is brewed fresh and served fresh at the peak of its flavor. If you're a tough customer, only the taste of this
radio show
will do. So go ahead, let Dunkin' Donuts make your
radio experience
exquisite.
Indeed.
Dunkin' Donuts, serving sweet treats from the pop underground. Thursdays, noon to 1.
All right. Thank you to Josh for producing that last segment, talking with Lena about the No Dakota Access Pipeline. And before we go, we wanted to touch on the U.S. presidential election, which just concluded last night. And as Nikita mentioned earlier, the results were very surprising to see Donald Trump win the election. I know earlier in the night, like Democracy Now! Was talking almost as if Hillary had already won before the results were coming in. So I think that she was expected to win. So I think surprising is the right word to use to describe the election results.
In some senses, yeah, I think.
Yeah, so we wanted to cover this topic, but we wanted to do it kind of from seeing kind of what the people are experiencing from this. So we decided to go on Twitter and read some election tweets about the election that happened last night. So Nikita, to start us off.
Yeah, so Hadi Michif Todd, who uses the Twitter handle at Zoe S. Todd, tweeted, quote, "So what I'm hearing is the white rural Americans went full settler colonial."
And Ruth Hopkins, at Ruth H. Hopkins, she tweeted out, "The Indian survived George Washington, Andrew Jackson, George Bush, and all their ilk. We will survive whoever comes next."
And also, with all the trends going on, including hashtag proud to be Canadian, from Stephen Cree, a very active Twitter
user.
Before getting on your proud to be Canadian rant, reflect for a moment the realities of this place and the racist foundation it's built upon. And I think this is really important to acknowledge, since we're still ourselves trying to figure out how to deal with how to talk about these things, especially on a platform like the radio. And I just want to acknowledge that these are very real fears and very real pain that's being felt today. And we need to acknowledge that and allow it to exist. I don't want to hear people telling people that it's fine, that it's going to be fine. Because for many, it's not fine right now. And I think we have to allow that pain to exist and that those wounds to heal and scar and scab. And this is a call to action, I think, for academics and allies of people of color, our outside, quote-unquote, cultural admirers and all our swag stealers. I think this is a call to action to stand up and hold our leadership accountable now, too, moving forward and seeing how our leaders react to having somebody like Donald Trump in such a powerful position. I think it's also a call to action for ourselves to look after ourselves and each other and to keep a fire in these cold, cold times.
Absolutely. And I think it's also really important to be critical of what the discourse is that's happening around the election. I mean, people are threatening to move to Canada from the States, and, you know, that's just, you know, escaping one problem to, you know, contribute to the next. It's not exactly a solution, but I think that ongoing rhetoric is something that we should be critical of as well. Even if you're not an academic, even if you hear people talking about this in conversation, you know, think about what's really going on. You can find us on our website at citr.ca. We're going to post the podcast on our social media platforms on Twitter and on Facebook. And that's all the time that we have for the show today. Coming up is Music for the Observant with Emily. But before we go, Matt, we have a song to play.
Yeah, I wanted to play the song today. I felt it was especially poignant. Sam Cooke's 1964 hit, Change is Gonna Come. I think the lyrics speak for themselves. So, yeah, let's just have a listen and reflect.
So this is Sam Cooke on Unceded Airwaves, broadcasting from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die. 'Cause I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. I go to the movie and I go downtown. Somebody keep telling me don't hang around. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. Then I go to my brother. Say, brother, help me, please. But he winds up knocking me back down on my knees. Oh, there have been times that I thought I couldn't last for long. It's been a long time coming, but I know